We take our weekly look at the top news in national politics, including primary elections in a handful of southern states last night and President Trump's pick for the next head of the Veterans Affairs Department.
In a few minutes, we'll talk about a Democratic campaign strategy unveiled yesterday that will focus on Washington corruption, and we want your take on this at 800-642-1234. Is a pledge to crack down on lobbying and campaign finance abuses important to you? Do you see it as a winning strategy for Democrats to point out what they see as corruption in the Trump administration? Or do you think corruption in Washington is a two-way street? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org.
Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with those primaries yesterday and Georgia's primary in the race for governor. This got a lot of attention on the Democratic side with Stacey Abrams winning, former state minority leader. She could become the first African-American female governor in the country. Can you talk a little bit about this primary there?
Sure. I mean, she's actually already made history because there's never been an African-American woman who has been a major party's nominee for governor. So it seems pretty incredible that hasn't happened until now, but Abrams is the first one. And so she really excited a lot of progressives around the country. She ran on a progressive platform, and she ran with the notion that her idea was that you don't have to sort of base your candidacy and sort of make your base those sort of more moderate, white, affluent suburban voters in Georgia, and instead that you can focus on, sort of the new majority, as it's known, the progressive white people, Latinos, Asian Americans, Black voters, especially Black women. That's a major part of the strategy. And so she did that without sort of going to the middle or something that angers a lot of progressives. And she ended up, that strategy paid off.
Let's give a listen to Abrams at her victory celebration last night talking about the campaign's approach.
We have to reach out to those who do not believe their voices matter, who've been disappointed again and again by promises made and never kept, who live in counties crushed by poverty and neglect, in suburbs isolated from jobs and opportunity, and sometimes from each other.
And this is a debate around the country, right, Amanda, for Democrats. Do they move to the middle, trying to capture maybe voters who moved to Trump after voting for Obama in the past? Or do they try to rally the base, natural Democratic Party supporters?
Yeah, it's been pretty much one of the biggest debates in the party since the 2016 election, I would say. You know, you have a lot of Democrats who say, look, some Democratic voters went to Trump because they feel like the party's not talking to them. And a lot of those voters tend to be white, working class voters, many of them in the Rust Belt areas. Should we focus on them? But there are other people who say, no, look, Democrats lost in part because they weren't paying enough attention to voters of color in cities, Black voters, for example. In Wisconsin, there was a lot of frustration that the Democratic Party didn't do enough in Milwaukee, for example. And so, you know, we need to pay more attention to these voters who are making up this new majority, and we shouldn't be going to the middle. That's not what voters want right now. And so that, in many ways, was tested in this race. And you've been seeing this play out in House races, too, with some progressives getting upset at the Democratic Campaign Congressional Committee, which is the committee that helps elect Democrats to the House, that they seem to be meddling, and they're known for often supporting more moderate candidates. And so you're seeing this struggle play out quite a bit.
I want to move to another race now in Kentucky. Amy McGrath, a former Marine fighter pilot, beat the mayor of Lexington in the primary for a House seat there. Why has that one been getting national attention?
Sure. That plays into a little bit of what I was just talking about. Amy McGrath, a first-time candidate. She's a female veteran. She was a fighter pilot, didn't have political experience, and didn't seem to have a shot. Now, the Democratic Party really wanted Mayor Jim Gray. He's the mayor of Lexington, popular mayor there, would have a lot of money. They really wanted him to enter the race. And it seemed like the DCCC was recruiting him and pushing him to get in. And now he did get in and looked like that he was going to be the winner. He was the front runner. But McGrath caught up in part because she had a really good campaign ad that got her national attention, where she talked about her experience as a female veteran. She was standing in front of a plane, I believe. And the DCCC backed off a little bit. Policy-wise, Amy McGrath and Mayor Gray really aren't that different. It was more in their style. McGrath tried to portray herself as this outsider and Gray as this insider, even though, you know, he was a mayor of a city. It's not like he had been in Congress already or something like that. So it was more stylistic differences, but people ended up choosing the political newcomer.
Before we move on from the primaries, I want to touch on a couple of themes. Some people have been pointing out, one in each party. First, for Democrats, a lot of women running and a lot of women apparently winning primaries. Do you see this as a trend on the Democratic side of things?
Yes, definitely more on the Democratic side than the Republican side. A lot of women running, obviously energized after the election of Donald Trump. You hear from many female candidates that, you know, the ones I've talked to who said, yeah, you know, I decided to get involved after seeing Trump get elected, after being energized by the Women's March, and just thought it was time. So you're seeing, you know, a lot of women run, a lot of women winning. And it'll be interesting to see when all the primaries shake out, actually how many women end up getting the nominations and then how many are able to win and go to Congress. If this is going to be another year of the woman, as we hear so much about, and if there will be a sort of a record number.
And on the Republican side, I've seen some analysts look at a place like Texas, where there were a handful of Republican incumbents not running again, saying, okay, the more conservative-backed candidates seem to be doing pretty well in those Republican primaries. Is that something you're watching for around the country?
Yes, definitely. I mean, Republicans, you know, the Republicans are definitely losing more members than you, having more members retire or resign or just say, you know, they're not running again than normal. A lot of those Republicans tend to be more moderates or Republicans who are in slightly tougher districts and just sort of see the writing on the wall. You know, they're in districts maybe that Hillary Clinton won in 2016, and that their district may be a little more purple and changing a bit, and they just figured now, you know, I'm not running for re-election in a year where Donald Trump is the president. I'm going to have to defend everything he says and types of things that aren't popular in my district. And those resignations make it harder for Republicans to keep the seat, because then you have primaries, and a lot of time what happens in the primaries is a more conservative candidate wins. But then that makes it harder to win in the general election for Republicans. And I think, you know, you're seeing some establishment Republicans also sort of getting very worried about that, that they're going to have some of these more extreme candidates that make it harder for them to hold on to the House and the Senate.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. Moving away from those primaries now, Amanda, last Friday, President Trump made what sounded like a surprise announcement about his nomination to be the next head of the Department of Veterans Affairs. That would be Robert Wilkie, who's been serving as the interim director. Now, this was unexpected, including to, as I understand it, the nominee himself.
Yes, it was unexpected. I mean, Trump said, you know, I'm making an announcement today. He doesn't even know this yet, but we're going to be nominating Robert Wilkie to be the Secretary of the Veterans Administration. And Robert Wilkie was in the audience. He stood up and went and shook the president's hand. But it's pretty incredible that the president announced it publicly before telling Robert Wilkie that he was going to do this. And you'd think Trump would want to be a little bit more cautious, considering what happened to the previous person he nominated for the job, Ronny Jackson, the White House doctor, who ended up withdrawing because he wasn't vetted before Trump announced him. It seemed like Trump picked him just basically because he liked him. And all these questions were raised about his former colleagues saying that he had sort of a volatile temper, that he drank while on the job and harassed staffers and all these other things. And so Wilkie seems like he's not going to have those same problems so far, but it was a surprise.
Yeah, with all the trouble at the VA over the years, the problem of the previous nominee, is Wilkie expected to have maybe an easier confirmation process?
Absolutely. He's already gone through the confirmation process for he was previously at the Defense Department, and you are not allowed to serve as the acting secretary of an agency when you're also nominated for the job. So Wilkie has stepped down as acting secretary of the VA and gone back to his old job at the Defense Department. So, you know, I think a lot of veterans groups I talked to, like the American Legion, also didn't know that he was going to get nominated, although they weren't surprised. And so far, senators have tentatively been saying positive things about Wilkie. You know, they're not committing necessarily to vote for him, but the red flags of Ronnie Jackson, it doesn't seem like it's going to be quite as much of a problem.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle, Huffington Post Washington Bureau Chief, about some of the week's top news in national politics.
After the break, we'll talk about the Democratic Party's plan to make corruption in Washington a midterm campaign issue, and we want your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is the way Washington operates something that's important to you? Do you think the Democrats are in a good place to call out corruption in the Capitol? Will this win over any swing voters? Maybe you are that swing voter. Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post, looking at the week in national politics. Amanda, you wrote about this, some leading Democrats in Congress talking about their midterm strategy focused on corruption. They say corruption in the Trump administration, the Republican Party. What kind of things are they talking about?
They are talking about, well, in the Trump administration is things like, I guess the best example is the EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. And he has had scandal after scandal, you know, using taxpayer money on expensive things in his office, like a soundproof booth, insisting on extra security because of death threats that don't really seem to be real, things like that. So, I think it's more obvious what they're doing with the Trump administration. But in Congress itself, it's not going to be so much individual scandals of Republican members, although if those come up, I'm sure they'll do them. But it's more things like the tax law. Democrats are going to be stressing that and arguing that, look, it's more of a giveaway to corporations and lobbyists who wanted this rather than helping individual people. And that feeds into this whole culture of corruption and incompetence. And it's not a government for the people. It remains to be seen how much this trickles down into the level of, will voters in Wisconsin, for example, in the individual districts, be seeing ads from candidates about this? Or is this more of a Washington talking point? Because I was in Wisconsin a couple months ago, and honestly, I wasn't hearing a ton of talk about Trump. People were more interested in talking about health care and other issues. So I don't know how this is going to play out, but Democrats say that this is going to be part of their messaging, and they're going to be trying to push policy proposals that address things like protecting the right to vote, campaign finance reform, and other things like that.
And you said there's an analogy here to 2006 when Democrats ran on a similar message and had some success with it.
They did. 2006 was the last time Democrats won back control of both the House and the Senate. And the culture of corruption was a major thing. I've had Republicans who were involved in House races in that cycle tell me that the culture of corruption theme that Democrats hammered was incredibly effective. And one difference was that there were a lot of scandals amongst House Republican members. The one most famous one was Mark Foley, who was inappropriately sending messages to teenage boys. And Republicans fully admit that they had a lot of scandals that year. But you also had, an unpopular president, President Bush, who was under fire for the Iraq War, for his handling of Hurricane Katrina. And that sort of climate helped Democrats as well. And so I think Democrats are hoping that the Trump effect will work similarly in their favor.
And while they're talking about these issues you just mentioned, did they talk about whether they're going to talk about Russia and the Russia probe and the Mueller probe? Are these things that they're not going to have front and center?
They didn't. That is one thing. I'm glad you brought that up, because that is one thing that they are not talking about as much. I was just at a conference here in Washington the other day where a lot of Democratic senators and other and governors and other public officials spoke. A lot of people who are being talked about as running in 2020. And you never really heard talk of Russia. It just doesn't come up much. Democrats are avoiding it because they are worried that if they run, they're just going to be running as too anti-Trump, and that they feel like that didn't work for Hillary Clinton in 2016. Democrats want to, voters want to hear more about actual solutions. So far you're not hearing a lot about Russia, but that could be changed, because there definitely are people in the party who think Democrats need to be talking about it more, because it's so central to sort of everything that's going on here.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post about some of the top stories in national politics. Well, we can talk about that probe right now, Amanda. Some of the latest news here, this talk about an informant who had worked for the FBI, talked to members of the Trump campaign during the 2016 election. The president talking and tweeting a lot about this, calling it Spygate. Can you talk about what's out there and how the president is responding?
Sure. So this is someone, the president is claiming his Trump's latest theory is that the Obama campaign paid someone to be inside his campaign and to work for his campaign in order to spy on him and help Hillary Clinton. There's absolutely no evidence that that happened. What we do know is that the FBI had a source who was in academia who assisted them in the Russia investigation. And what he did is he reached out to members of Trump's inner circle, I believe at least three people, and talked to them in what appears to be centered on foreign policy. He never worked for the Trump campaign. He wasn't embedded in the Trump campaign. He was simply reaching out and having meetings to gain more information.
But the president clearly is talking about this. What are people making of what he's saying and how it could impact public perception of the FBI investigation?
Well, the president now and his allies are really, really trying to turn the public against the investigation and against Robert Mueller more specifically, who was very popular when he took the job as special counsel. But even people who have been defending him on the Republican side are feeling like maybe this is going on a little too long. It's now been more than a year since he launched his investigation, or since he took over as special counsel. Trump is trying to make as many people have doubts about Robert Mueller and the investigation. And so that is why you see him tweeting. That is why you see his allies going on air and saying that this is partisan, that Robert Mueller is on a witch hunt. I mean, Robert Mueller is a lifelong Republican, but if you listen to what a lot of Trump allies are saying, it sounds like he is some Democratic plant. Rod Rosenstein, the Justice Department official who oversees Robert Mueller in the investigation, another lifelong Republican. But if you listen to some of the conservative commentary, it sounds like he's a Democrat. So, you know, in short, they're trying to plant as much doubt as possible and turn the public against the investigation because they feel like a lot of this is going to be won in the public sphere.
Want to move on to another story. The summit, the planned summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, scheduled for June 12th, but that's kind of up in the air now. Here's President Trump talking yesterday at the White House.
Well, we're moving along and we'll see what happens. There are certain conditions that we want, and I think we'll get those conditions. And if we don't, we don't have the meeting. And frankly, it has a chance to be a great, great meeting for North Korea and a great meeting for the world.
So where is this planned meeting right now?
I think it's up in the air. It's not 100% clear if it's going to happen. It's still on as of now. But, I think that the Trump administration is getting nervous that they're going to look foolish. I mean, Trump clearly really wants this, and he keeps talking about it, and he keeps basically declaring victory before anything has even happened, which he often does. But North Korea has indicated that, you know, they're not going to just give Trump what he wants, which is unilateral disarmament for absolutely nothing in return from the United States other than basically this meeting. North Korea is saying we're not going to do that, which I think everyone expected North Korea wouldn't go along with that. And so I think Trump and his administration is starting to get a little nervous that they could come out of this looking bad. And so you're hearing now Trump saying, for example, it might not be unilateral disarmament right away. It might happen over time, and he might be okay with that. And they're trying to set expectations now a little bit differently. I mean, you know, you had some Republicans in Congress saying Trump deserves the Nobel Peace Prize for what he's done already. So expectations are incredibly high, maybe a little bit too high. So as of now, the summit's on, but, you know, I don't think anyone would be surprised if something happens and it's canceled.
Right. North Korea had objected to planned exercises, military exercises between the U.S. and South Korea, saying that was provocative in the run-up to this. we've got two, I think it's fair to say, unconventional world leaders in President Trump and Kim Jong-un. Is it hard to predict what's going to happen from day to day between these two countries now?
Yes, it is. It's very hard to happen. I mean, I think, you know, some months ago, not many people would predict that there would be a summit planned based on Trump calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man and, you know, basically seeming to threaten attacking North Korea. I mean, things were in a pretty dire place. And so to be here now is very surprising to people. But North Korea, you know, often finds excuses for pulling back. Trump is unpredictable as well, as we know, as is Kim Jong-un. So, yes, unpredictability is the main thing here. And so that's why I said if it's canceled, I don't think anyone will be surprised.
And very briefly, Amanda, some news broke this afternoon. I don't know if you've seen it. It's been on the Twitter and all over the place. A judge ruled that President Trump can't block people from following him on Twitter or responding to him on Twitter under First Amendment grounds. Is that one you'd been watching?
I mean, I hadn't been following it closely, but I think that will obviously probably annoy Trump because his Twitter feed is very close to him. But I mean, he is the president of the United States, and if people want to try to talk to him, apparently they're going to get to do it. So it'd be funny to see Trump's reaction as he learns of that ruling.
Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Amanda Turkel, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. She was with us for our weekly look at some of the latest stories in national politics.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out how dead cattle may be bad news for the ecosystem of the Upper Midwest. I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Remember, you can always listen online at WPR.org and follow all of our conversations here on the Ideas Network or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to your smartphone or tablet. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.